At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Policy Center Legislative Briefing. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of Commonwealth Policy Center, here with State Senator Mike Wilson, Majority Whip of the Kentucky State Senate. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Richard. It's good to be with you.
Hey, it's really good to have you here. We're in Frankfort, and you've been in session the last couple of days.
Right.
You've dealt with a lot of hot issues, contentious issues.
Yes.
And absolutely. I'd like us to dig in for the benefit of the Kentucky citizens out there to unpack some of the more challenging issues. And I think the first issue that's receiving a lot of media attention is the legislature's restrictions of Governor Andy Beshear's executive authority. Senate Bill 1 addresses that. Just tell us briefly some of the high points in that bill.
Well, basically, what you've had is the governor for the last 333 days has put us under a state of emergency with COVID. And under that, he's issued all kinds of executive orders or emergency orders that have actually shut down schools, shut down restaurants, businesses, you know, all of these things that he's done to our economy. And so our response to that is say, you know, we reached out to the governor. He wouldn't talk to us for 10 months. And when he finally did was to tell us what he was going to do, not to get any input from those that are closest to the people. Senate Bill 1 restricts the governor to the point that he says an emergency can only last 30 days. Now, he can renew it, but he has to be able to call the legislature in to do that. It's not many times in our past history it's happened. But in a situation like that, we would be amenable to be coming in and extending the emergency. It just balances the power is what it does between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
So this bill was essentially born from the need for the governor to work with legislators across the state who are really the eyes and ears of the state, of their districts. Really, you've got your ear close to what the people are saying.
Right.
And this rectifies that gap between the governor, if you will, and the districts and the different regions of the state.
Right. It gives more equal power. And if you will, like any business that I've ever, you know, been a part of where I've headed up the business, I've always relied on my department heads to come together, put our heads together and make really good decisions. And he hasn't done that with calling to the Senate or the House and the leadership there to talk to them who have experience and make those decisions. It's been kind of a one-man show in all of that.
Mike, you and I know that a number of businesses have been impacted in Kentucky. You're from the Bowling Green area, a lot of businesses there. This is something where you've seen firsthand how it's impacted the business owners and the people who work at these various businesses. Give us a snapshot of what this 333 days of unchecked executive authority have looked like in the Bowling Green area.
Well, I can tell you, we have a lot of restaurants because we draw from 10 counties that people come in to shop and eat in Bowling Green because we're the third largest city. And shutting down our restaurants has been nothing short of a travesty. You have restaurants that are still required to pay the taxes that they're currently paying every year, and yet they have no income. And all of the employees have laid off and they were drawing unemployment, but yet there's a huge problem with that. So there's no income for these folks that are laid off from all of the businesses and restaurants. So they have no ability to have money to spend to infuse into our local economy. And it's really been devastating to our area.
Have many of the restaurants closed? I spend quite a bit of time in Bowling Green. A lot of good restaurants there.
Yes.
Have many of them closed?
You know, as far as not opening back up, I know there are some that have not opened back up, but most of them are at 50% capacity right now. And people are so tired, they want get the mask off my face, get my kids back in school. And, you know, that's a key thing that they want right now, and get the restaurants open. Yeah. And they are packing out the restaurants, even at 50% capacity.
I wish the best for you and your community as we move towards recovery. I know it's been hard on the business owners, hard on the citizens in these districts. And I do hope that Bowling Green gets back on its feet. I want to go back to one of the provisions in the bill, something that was charged against the bill recently, and that is that the Senate Bill 1 gives the governor powers of eminent domain in an emergency. Can you speak to that? I think you've heard this.
Yes, I've already heard this, and I can tell you that that was not something new that was in Senate Bill 1. It already exists under emergency powers. So when you're doing a bill, you're going to list the section, and that was part of the section that was listed, though it was not new language. It's already there, and it's, you know, for those things, it's like if there was a flood or disaster, and in order to build like an earthen dam or something like that, needed to procure some property, all of the laws of eminent domain still apply to that, you know, as far as being, you know, given the, I guess, right amount of money for it and stuff like that.
So this was existing law. This provision that was spelled out in Senate Bill 1 was already on the books.
The
governor had eminent domain authority in a time of an emergency, natural disaster, as you mentioned. But this was not something the legislature created.
No.
You did amend it to specify, if I recall correctly, that the state has to reimburse accordingly if they see somebody's property.
Yes, that was added to it. That's correct.
So you fixed something that was wrong.
Yeah, we just added that, which it really already exists, if, you know, as far as I understand it. But we just put it in there to make sure that people understood that that still applied.
There is a constitutional provision worth mentioning as well in the U.S. Constitution that says private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation.
Exactly.
So you're just codifying that into state law.
Yes.
Just to make sure that the government pays somebody when they take their property or goods.
Just compensation, you're right.
Yeah. So I want to go to why the legislature's acting now. The governor had free rein last year. But why are you acting on this now? You've been in session for a couple, of course, few days in January. Now here we're on the beginning of February. Why not wait until this pandemic is over?
Well, the thing about it is, like I said, we've been in this emergency for 333 days. And that's something the governor has not considered us on. And we do not have the ability to call ourselves back into session. And so for us, we had to wait till January till we got back into session before we could even act on anything like this.
So you didn't have it within your power as the legislative body, as the lawmakers of Kentucky, you could not do anything. Your hands were tied, is
exactly.
That correct?
Exactly. Okay. Only he could call us into session under extraordinary session.
Senator Wilson, is there an effort to allow the legislature to call itself into session?
Yes, there is a bill from the Speaker of the House that will allow us to call ourselves into session in the case of emergency.
Okay. So that's the House side. You're in the Senate. What's your guess if the House passes it? Do you think something like that would be received favorably on the Senate side?
Oh, absolutely. I can tell you that we have members in the Senate that are working with House members and the Speaker right now to make sure that that bill is what it should be so it can pass both chambers.
And this is a constitutional amendment?
Yes, it is.
So tell us what that means.
Constitutional amendment, you can only have, I think, we can pass two and the House can pass two. It's kind of how it works. And every time there's an election, which is every 2 years, it can go on the ballot for voters to vote on it. So there's no ballot that it will be on in 21, but in 22 in November, it'll be on the ballot.
Okay, so if this constitutional provision was passed this year, it would go on to next year's ballot, November of 2022.
That's correct.
Okay. So there was a lawsuit immediately after you passed Senate Bill 1. The governor's office filed a lawsuit against this, saying that the legislature didn't have authority.
No, he actually vetoed it first, and then we came back and overrode the vetoes, overrode them. And then he filed a lawsuit immediately following the fact that we had, you know, he filed against Senate Bill 1, Senate Bill 2, House Bill 1, and I believe it was House Bill 3. Mm-hmm. Or House Bill 2.
Okay. Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. So the Judge Philip Shepherd here in Franklin County did take action on that?
Yeah. There was an order that just came down, and actually the governor filed for injunctive relief, I believe, on this and Shepherd only came out with the one on House Bill 1.
Okay. Very good. Senator Wilson, I'd like to move on to another issue. We're running out of time here, but HHR, top issue right now in the legislature. HHR stands for Historical Horse Racing.
Right.
And this is something that the horse tracks have implemented going back 10 years ago, not far from your district. Kentucky
right.
Downs was
right.
the first track to set up essentially, as I see it, it's a casino gambling venue. Slot machines, they're video slot machines. You put your money in, you press the button. If you get three or four of a kind, then you win the jackpot. Now, they say that this is more related to horse racing than it is to casino gambling because people are betting on a historical horse race, a previously run horse race. And in some of the original machines, they actually had a little video of the last 2 seconds of a horse race.
Right.
And they said this is not video gambling, it's HHR. What are you? Have you seen these things? What are your thoughts on that? Is this more related to horse racing than it is to like video poker, video blackjack?
I don't think so. I think they're akin to slot machines, personally, and I haven't seen one. You know, I haven't actually been into one of the horse tracks parlors, I guess you would call it. I have been to the horse races, and I think I walked through, but I wasn't really paying attention to a horse race or to those as I went to the horse race. But yes, they are akin to slot machines, and their argument was that it's not, you know, slot machines. It's, you know, the historical horse racing is pari-mutuel betting. And of course, the Supreme Court came out with a unanimous decision, said that, no, it's not pari-mutuel betting. And so they left it up to the legislature to define what pari-mutuel betting is, which is what the bill is in the Senate.
So this bill that is before you right now would redefine pari-mutuel. It would expand the definition to include essentially gambling on video slot machines.
Yes, it would include the HHR machines.
One of the big arguments the horse industry has is that we need to shore up the purses for the horse races here in Kentucky. We need to have breeding incentives for the horse farms here, and Kentucky cannot compete with other states that have HHR machines, video slot machines. How do you respond to that? This is our signature industry.
Right? Well, I don't know that if it's necessarily a signature industry, but it is a industry that when people, you know, talk about or hear you're from Kentucky, they know about the Kentucky Derby. They know about bourbon. Those two things for sure. So it's, from that standpoint, I don't think that it's going to collapse as it's people say it will. Has it helped the equine industry? Yes. It has made greater purses. It has brought more brood mares and breeding and stuff into our state. In regards to that, but I think the term, how much it was last year was $21 million. The money they take in from that, they could afford to do a whole lot more than that. So,
one last question, and we're just about out of time, but if the Horse Racing Commission, the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission legitimized this 10 years ago, they said this is really a horse racing type activity, we're going to legalize it. If this was really, truly illegal the whole time, why didn't anybody take action to stop them?
Well, they did. It was in the courts. It was tied up in the courts.
So there was a lawsuit?
10 years.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So that was, that's what happened, and the lawsuit came down, and, you know, with the order from the Supreme Court, Stan Cave was the representing attorney for the Family Foundation. Which I know you're well acquainted with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now they're coming to us, as one of my colleagues said, you know, looking for us to bail them out.
Yeah, very good. Senator Mike Wilson, we are out of time. Thank you so much. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. Big gambling is at it again. They're trying to get the Kentucky legislature to cover a bad bet that they made 10 years ago. That's when the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission redefined the word parimutuel, and that was in order for them to bring in video slot machines, otherwise known as the crack cocaine of gambling. All this while there was a lawsuit filed. Now, of all the people who should understand that you shouldn't put the cart before the horse, it's Kentucky's horse racing industry. But they did it anyway. Now they're asking your legislators to bail them out of their illegal and unwise decisions. The law applies to everyone, and no one business interest is above the law. If you believe that, call the legislative message line right now and ask your legislator to oppose any gambling expansion bill. The number is 800-372-7181. Again, the number is 800-372-7181. Call and tell them to stop gambling expansion right now.
Welcome back to the Commonwealth Policy Center Legislative Briefing. And with me in this segment is State Senator Whitney Westerfield from Hopkinsville. Senator Westerfield, welcome to the program.
Good to see you, Richard.
Hey, you have been immersed in the legislative session, I guess maybe the second half of the session. You were in for about a week or so in January.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in the first week of February, and you've had a lot of challenging issues, I'll put it that way, important issues, important decisions that the legislature is making. And one of those is a life issue. You have been known as an advocate for the sanctity of human life in the state legislature. And there was a bill that you introduced last year that was vetoed by Governor Beshear. It was the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. And essentially the Born Alive bill would protect those babies who survive a botched abortion.
Survive, or it would protect any baby that's born alive, whether it's from a failed abortion attempt, a premature birth, or anything. It doesn't make a distinction there. If they're born alive, it requires reasonable and appropriate medical care.
As I understand it, this came about after some troubling comments were made by Governor Ralph Northam.
Absolute
in Virginia.
Grotesque comments, in my opinion.
Essentially, he was saying that if there's a baby that survives a botched abortion, it's really up to the mother and the doctor.
We would set the child aside, make it comfortable, and a conversation would be had about what to do. Just some of the most abhorrent things I've ever seen. When I learned that Kentucky didn't have a law that required that such a child be given medical care, I filed it actually 2 years ago in 2019. It came late in the session shortly after those comments. And then, of course, it just didn't make it all the way through in 19. Last year, as you've said, Governor Beshear vetoed it. And this year, he didn't veto it, but he didn't have the nerve to sign it into law. So it's law anyway, despite his lack of signature.
Well, so I want to, since he brought that up, was this because of the pressure he faced? He was very adamant last year. He said this bill isn't necessary.
Yeah, his veto message said last year that we already have a law in the books that does this. We don't. That we don't need to do something that's unconstitutional. It has never been challenged successfully in the country that I'm aware of or that anybody else is. Mm-hmm. And that we don't need to be doing something so divisive as protecting unborn and now newly born life during a pandemic. I don't know what made him change his tune, but he couldn't bring himself to sign it into law. And that's fine. We were ready to override the veto had he issued one. I'll take it any way I can get it.
Very good. I want to read a statement that the Kentucky ACLU has on their website regarding Senate Bill 9, the Born Alive Bill. They say this, and I quote, "The so-called protection of infants born alive during an abortion is not based in the real-life practice of medicine. It serves only to shame and ostracize patients and healthcare providers. SB 9 is one part of Kentucky General Assembly's years-long campaign to push abortion care out of reach bit by bit," end quote. I pulled that off their website earlier today. So is they say this is not based on the real life practice of
they're
medicine.
They're wrong.
So speak to that.
Well, we've actually had abortion survivors testify before the legislative committees in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. My friend Senator Matt Castlin had the heartbeat bill a couple of sessions ago, or a session or two ago, and we had abortion survivors come in and testify. So we know that there are people who survive abortions. Likewise, the bill, and if you'll look, at the very end, I added some language to this year's version of it from last year's. It can also be referred to as the Avison Act. A little girl named Ava, that's what her family calls her, and Ava was born at 22 weeks and 4 days at a hospital in central Kentucky. Not a failed abortion attempt, just a premature birth. Mm-hmm. And that hospital decided we're not going to provide care for that little girl. Mm-hmm. And the family begged for care. and they didn't get it. And there are hospitals that have different rules and standards. I've been texted by my friends and colleagues in Jefferson County where they've got a slew of hospitals, and each one does things a little bit differently, and they might be willing to give care if it's born earlier or later. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure that if a child's born alive, whenever it is, that it's given appropriate, not extreme measures, but appropriate and responsible and reasonable medical care. And it allows the doctor to make that decision. We can't legislate what that is for every situation.
Yeah.
But I think the argument that these situations don't exist is demonstrably proved false.
Groups like the ACLU and reproductive freedom groups, as they're called, say that this restricts women's reproductive rights.
Their own doctors in both the House and the Senate, two different physicians, testify that it wouldn't change their practice. I they're not even consistent with their own marketing spin on their website.
Okay. So in 2003, at the federal level, there was a federal Born Alive Infant Protection Act. Is this not redundant?
Not at all. I invite folks to read. It's a 2002 federal law, and I'm glad it's there, but it's sort of useless. It's good for show. It's less than one page long. It provides a couple of definitions, and that's it. Mm-hmm. There's no requirement for care. There's no penalty for healthcare providers who are given a duty and don't meet it. There's nothing. There's no there. There's no substance to it. I'm glad that the federal government decided and the Congress decided to define it, but we need something with more teeth. And even if they passed it, you could make the argument that that only applies to federally funded or federally operated healthcare facilities and not all the other ones. We needed this protection, and we needed a protection that actually does some protecting, and that's why Senate Bill 9 exists.
Senator Westfield, how do you respond when somebody says the Right to Life community only cares about unborn life or the newly born life, but after that, then they don't really care?
Then they aren't getting to know members of the pro-life community. The number of people who go out of their way to... I got an email this morning from the Knights of Columbus, and there are thousands of members of the Knights of Columbus and church groups from the Kentucky Baptist Convention to the Catholic churches in Kentucky to every faith community that provide to pregnancy care centers all over the Commonwealth that care for women who are post-abortive, who care for women who are facing crisis pregnancies, and then nurture them, provide resources for them after the child's born.
Yeah.
There are a ton of things that we've done. We're recording this on Wednesday evening, February the 3rd. On February the 4th, the Kentucky Senate Judiciary Committee will hear Dignity Bill, the Dignity 2.0 bill. It's the second bill sponsored by Julie Rocky Adams that provides some protections for incarcerated pregnant women.
Mm.
And it's the second such bill that we've done like this. They're ignoring it, or conveniently leaving out the work that we're doing to protect life at all stages.
So this is just one part of the pro-life movement. You're protecting the vulnerable who've survived an abortion, but the pro-life movement actually has been involved and engaged in other aspects of human life, other
Absolutely.
Developmental stages
Absolutely.
Of human life. Actually, so you're very familiar, and I am too. I'm from the same area that you are, but Hopkinsville has a pregnancy care center, as you mentioned, which is a ministry to help women who are pregnant, women who've had their babies, and they provide encouragement and sustenance.
Absolutely.
Life
material,
skills.
Material resources and things that they need, from diapers to car seats, showing them how to install a car seat, all for completely free. Ultrasounds for those that are expecting. It's Alpha Pregnancy Care Center in Hopkinsville. There's Life Choice over in Russellville that's a few years old. Another great facility that does the exact same work. And they cater to these families before pregnancy and after.
Yeah. And then, as you mentioned, post-abortive women, which is really an unspoken...
And the ACLU never talks about that.
Yeah.
They're all about getting the abortion, but these women that are going through it, I've talked to them myself.
Yeah.
They need that emotional help because that's a traumatic thing for women based on what they've shared with me. But that's a traumatic experience, and there are places like Alpha and like Life Choice that exist to provide that care and love for women that have gone through that.
Very good. Thank you for filling us in on that. That's good for us to know. I want to pivot to another very challenging issue that just came up the other day.
Yeah.
A bill was proposed to change the definition of paramutual to allow that to or to be interpreted as to extend to video slot machines, what they call historical horse racing.
Historical horse racing is marketing spin. These are slot machines in every way.
This is a personal issue for you because in your district, in Christian County, One of these venues opened up, the Oak Grove Racing venue and gaming venue opened up back, I believe it was September. Were you shocked to see this happen? It happened fairly quickly. The decision was made maybe a year, year and a half ago.
Yeah, I think it came along pretty quickly. I'm disappointed. I'm certainly grateful for jobs in my community and in my district. But I'm disappointed because these jobs and this economic impact comes at a great cost to Kentuckians, and particularly our poor, because those are the folks that patronize these machines. Mm-hmm. The upper class, upper middle class, and wealthy don't go to play slot machines. It's a sucker's bet. And the report from the historical horse racing machines, these slot machines, and the Racing Commission show that. They take in billions, and they pay out a fraction of that back to the people who bet. An even smaller, tiny fraction ends up going to the general fund. But I think it's cruel that we prey on our poorest people that way.
According to a recent opinion piece in the Courier-Journal, Louisville Courier-Journal by Dale Romans, he talked about how much has been invested in the HHR venues, about $100 million annually actually comes in from these investments in state and local taxes.
I don't dispute any of those numbers. I haven't verified them, but I don't question them, and I don't know this man or question his integrity. But,
and let me correct, if I could, correct. So this was actually the overall racetracks. It's more than just HHR. This is
sure.
This is the economic impact that the tracks have.
But remember, the impact that they've had over the last 10 years because of these slot machines, the 3,600 they've installed around the state, they did that knowing that the legal footing they were standing on was shaky.
Let's talk about that. So why was it shaky?
They sought an opinion, a one-sided effort. They didn't bring anybody adversarial to their cause. All the tracks, the commission, everybody went in together a decade ago and sought an opinion from the Franklin Circuit Court according to a statute asking them, you know, can we do what we're doing? Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court, in a decision issued back in 2014, actually spoke to that and said, look, before the Family Foundation entered this, you didn't have an action we could act on. You've got to have an adversarial proceeding there. And which means you've got to have somebody opposed to this to be asking for the same sort of question. Mm-hmm. And so Family Foundation joined that lawsuit, but that was the genesis of this. They knew from the outset that what they were doing was questionably illegal. And they did it anyway. They've made a bad bet by installing thousands of these machines. And I suspect all the folks that they've hired around the state, all the contractors to build the facilities and the employees staffing them as we're recording this tonight, I'm assuming when they hired him, they didn't say, now, by the way, we're bringing you on board, but we're still fighting this litigation, and now we're fighting it out in the legislature. We're not sure if it's going to be legal or not. I suspect they probably didn't. They should have, but they didn't.
So they gambled when
That's
they
right.
went ahead and invested in this new infrastructure when a lawsuit was filed against them, and yet they continued. And it's been going
for
on
a decade,
for 10 years. Now we have six tracks in Kentucky that have HHR
and
venues.
And a unanimous decision for the Supreme Court said they lost that bet, and they're coming to the General Assembly to bail them out.
It was the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission that made that decision and said, hey, this is more akin to horse racing than it is to casino-type gambling. They legitimized it, and yet there was that lawsuit that challenged it. Senator Westerfield, I want to pivot to something else. What do you say to the person who argues that, you know, people are gambling in Kentucky anyway? They're going across state lines. They're going to Indiana. They're going to Ohio. They're going to other states, and they're gambling there. Why not just build the venues here, recapture some of that tax revenue?
Well, two things. First, some of them are already doing that in other places. But when there's a facility in Oak Grove, there's more, and there is in South Christian. Now there are more people going to Oak Grove than would have gone somewhere else. So when you make it local and easier and more convenient, there's going to be more action there than would have gone in some other state. Secondly, and this really gets to the heart of the matter when it comes to gaming, we're still preying on our poorest. Mm. And they're still putting money in. They're willfully doing it. It's their choice. But they're using what little disposable income they have in hopes of striking it rich and not being saddled with poverty anymore. I think it's particularly cruel to prey on those Kentuckians and either to make ends meet or to make purses bigger. The industry is important, and I don't want to hurt the horse industry, but the free market says they need to find a way to do this without hurting, in my opinion, without hurting Kentucky's poorest people. And in this case, I think the only way to do that is by constitutional amendment. and they haven't tried that yet.
Very good. On that note, Senator Westerfield, we're going to have to close. We're out of time. It's been really good having you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Richard.
And thank you for tuning in to the Commonwealth Policy Center Legislative Briefing. God bless.